Welcome to the Winter Olympic version of the Lou Jones Breakfast Club. Medal count right now for the Dutch. We're in the orange. Is right up there. As you know, we have swept two events. So, go Dutchies. We've got a panel today, second time around, a little more information on lean stripping in Chapter 13. We're going to get to that in a minute. We've got a title company expert here to help us craft these orders. It wasn't... And he's going, no!
What?
We've also got donuts in the back. Thanks to Andy, so please help yourself. I don't want any of those around. It'll interfere with my skating. But before we get to our lean stripping panel, who can introduce themselves, of course. We've got Richard Grosnick here. He's got some changes that we need to be aware of with the IRS and the district council's office, et cetera. So, Rich, take it away.
When people think of the Internal Revenue Service, they think of bad news. Obvious for me to disappoint you. Due to the congressional budget cuts, bankruptcy is undergoing some fundamental changes with the IRS, and they're not going to help you. One of the things I want to mention up front is that what I'm telling you today is what I know as of today. Because of the sweeping nature of these changes, it's not really being coordinated very well, and so a lot of the things that I tell you today may be modified or changed as the service comes into contact with some of these issues that they really haven't thought out very well. But as far as I know, these are the changes that the IRS plans to implement over the next few months. First of all, the Office of Chief Counsel, which I am a part, will no longer be representing the IRS in bankruptcy court. This job will devolve back upon the United States Attorney's Office, Susan Knapel's office. They will be handling representing the IRS in all proceedings. You file an objection, that's going to go to her office. Adversary proceedings will continue to be handled by the Department of Justice in Washington. So if you file an adversary proceeding, a DOJ attorney will fly out and handle that. That's a change, but it's actually a relatively minor change. You can deal with a different attorney. What you're going to have a lot more problems dealing with is the changes to insolvency. Insolvency, which is our bankruptcy division, is going to a computer-based system, which is a mainframe in Philadelphia called Centralized Insolvency. That is designed to replace the human beings you've been dealing with. When I started here in Milwaukee 3.5 years ago, we had 7 persons working insolvency for the Eastern District of Wisconsin, including a tech advisor, Val Thomas, who knew more about bankruptcy than just about anybody else I know. As of the end of 2014, we'll have 2. All right? And both of those are a retirement age. However long they last is up to them. What changes will they be faced with? Well, first of all, up till now, when we have offsets of taxpayers' refunds, we file a motion to lift stay. That's going to be true only in cases where we have post-decree or pre-to-post. In other words, a post-petition refund that's applied to a pre-petition debt, or a pre-petition refund that's applied to a post-petition debt. If it's a pre-petition refund applied to a pre-petition debt, we will not lift the stay, we will not notify you, it's simply going to happen. Your client will get a letter from us saying it's happening. If it's a post-petition refund being applied to a post-petition debt, we used to lift the stay, not anymore. The national office has determined that it is not a stay violation and they are not going to file motions on those. Again, your client will get a letter. If we file a 1305 claim, we will send an offset letter to the trustee, but you are not going to get notice. 1305 claims, those are administrative claims that we file when a taxpayer has tax debts beyond the filing year. Previously, we had filed those, and your client has a debt for 2014, 2015, we would file a 1305 claim. For a while, it looked like we were going to discontinue those altogether. As of today, the policy is that we will file them once. So your client has a post-petition tax debt, we will file a 1305 claim. If they have one in a second year, we're going to file a motion to convert or dismiss, and they will probably get a lock-in letter changing their withholding. Again, this is what's being talked about, but that's what they have told me as of today's date. Okay? If we file a 1305 claim and your client sends the money to us directly, we're going to either send it back to them or we're going to apply it and not help anybody, including the trustee. So it's a bad idea. Tell your clients, if we got a proof of claim filed, pay the trustee. Because if they pay us, it's going to screw things up because the trustee is going to overpay us and that money is going to get lost to your clients one way or another. All right? Same thing if your client has a tax return that's for a pre-petition year that they file after the bankruptcy has started. If they file, like, for example, a 2010 return after the bankruptcy, you're going to, and they want to make a direct payment on that, the money is going to be lost. It's going to be sent into the IRS. It's not going to get applied to the 2010 year. It's going to float into a general collectible account eventually. 6 months, a year later, we'll apply it correctly. That's not going to help you now. Okay. A second big change that's coming is that if you have a priority tax that's listed on our proof of claim as a priority, you all pay that in full, right? We don't include penalties and interest because we can't. The service has determined that that is a non-dischargeable debt and they are now collecting it after the bankruptcy finishes. This is a change to Milwaukee. It's not a change to most of the rest of the country, but we haven't done that in the past. We've abated those amounts. They will not be abated anymore. Once the bankruptcy finishes, your clients are going to get a letter and they're going to be told they owe these amounts and they're going to have to pay them. All right, tolling periods. When you get a proof of claim and you look at the years, you say, wait a minute, this is well over the 3 year period. This should be discharged. We've talked about those. Those are situations where if the IRS files a substitute for return, that time period is tolled and consequently will not be dischargeable. There are other things that toll the statute of limitations, prior bankruptcies, tax court proceedings, collection due process proceedings. The statute provides that the IRS will continue the statute of limitations for that period, plus an additional 90 days. The service has now determined that that 90-day period is going to be for each successive bankruptcy filing or other delay. So if your client has filed two previous bankruptcies and a tax court proceeding, all those periods plus 270 days is going to be added on to the period that their taxes are not discharged. Okay. Post-petition filing of returns. Up till now, when you have sent in your returns to insolvency, they have amended the proof of claim based on the receipt of those returns. Nationally, they're not going to do that anymore. They're going to wait for those returns to go to the service center and be processed. If you file a return today that is not a 2013 return, that return will not be processed until May or June, which means no change to the proof of claim. I understand that insolvency will continue at this time to process returns that you deliver to them directly. In other words, you mail into insolvency in Milwaukee. When their workload becomes too great, they will drop that. Okay? What do I mean by too great? I mean phone calls. Right now, it's very common for your clients to get a refund offset notice, or they don't know where the refund is, or they get a notice from the IRS, and what do you tell them? You say, call insolvency, they'll tell you what to do. There's two of them left, actually three right now. Once the phone calls get too great, they're going to shut them off, and they will not take calls from your clients, they will not take calls from you. It's completely up to you how long insolvency continues to answer the phone. If you let your clients call them, they're going to be shut off. So if at all possible, don't have your clients call insolvency. Try to call them yourself or limit the kinds of calls that you make. The two things that you most likely run into are situations where your plan is not agreeable to us, or you have a tax that looks to be dischargeable and we're listing it on our proof of claims. If those situations arise, one of the things you can do is order a transcript from us. We've had transcript processes in the past that haven't been the greatest. The IRS just introduced a new one called Get Transcript. Like, where's my refund? You go to the IRS.gov website and you look it up. It is a work in progress. I can't get it to work, but I'm assured that they are working on it. And at some point in the near future, your clients will be able to order transcripts directly from the IRS that you can see whether or not they are dischargeable. We send out a letter called the Letter 1714 when your clients are missing returns. There have been some issues with that. We're going to hold off on that until after the filing season. So your clients aren't going to get notices of past due returns. Presumably, the trustee will notify you if you don't have the returns and you can deal directly with them. Those are the changes that I'm aware of. There's going to be other ones as the computer systems get up and running more and more. I will continue to handle cases. It was supposed to be the 1st of January. It's now been moved back to the 15th of April. Filing season ends. That's when my transfer of duties happens and I transfer or allow the new referrals to go to the U.S. Attorney's Office, I will continue, I understand, to handle any cases that have been assigned to me and that they conclude. I don't want to leave you in the lurch. If you have a problem, call me. I will try to help you to the best of my ability. I will be handling tax court litigation from now on in, but I should still, I talked to my boss about this, and he's going to give me some time to be able to answer questions. I won't be able to do some of the things I've done in the past, but hopefully, if you have a question, call me before you call insolvency, and we'll see if we can work it out. The other thing I'm going to continue to do is, instead of insolvency making a direct referral when a plan does not provide for our secure claim, and trust me, if we have a secure claim on our proof of claim, if it's not listed specifically in your plan, we will pay the IRS proof of claim. Even if your plan says claim controls, we are going to object. You're going to get an objection on that. The easiest way to do it is just put language in your plan saying, if the IRS has a secure claim, we will pay according to that claim as determined by the court or as ultimately determined. That way you can still object to the claim if you disagree with it. But if you don't have language in there referring to our secured claim, we will object. I will try to send you an email before this happens and let you know that an objection is coming. If you can fix it before that happens, great. If not, we'll be dealing with the U.S. Attorney's Office. I appreciate working with you all, and I hope to be able to communicate with you in the future. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Jay, will you start us off?
Good morning. I'm Jay Pittner. I represent mortgage creditors. We're here to talk about title considerations, sort of following up on the lien stripping conversation we had last October. Also with us are Andy Golanowski and Tim Hassel. They represent debtors. And our featured speaker today is Dwayne Wunsch from Fidelity National Title. So, why don't you tell us about title insurance and lien stripping?
Thank you very much, Jay. Thank you, Judge Kelly. I'm Dwayne Wunsch. I'm from Fidelity National Title Group. I'm with one title insurance company. And I must admit, before I came today, I wondered, you know, what could I possibly say to anyone who practices debtor-creditor law that would be of interest? For those of you who have ever encountered anything with title, boredom comes to mind, because examining documents that affect title is not many people's idea of an exciting vocation. And I can illustrate this by telling you a story of a woman who was very sick, and she went to the hospital and had a number of tests, and after the test she met with her doctor, and the doctor said to her, "I don't know how to tell you this, but you only have 3 more months to live." And the woman said, "Doctor, what am I going to do?" And he said, "Marry a title agent." "But doctor, will that really help me live longer?" "No, but it will seem longer." I hope it won't seem that long for you today, but I hope that, you know, we can discuss some issues that are of interest and that are important to you. I've been with the company that I've been with for about 36 years, and so in the real estate transactions area, our work is very secular. When interest rates are high and when there's a recession, then our work is very slow. And when interest rates are low, like they were in 2002 to 2007, our business is extremely busy. And the carelessness, I guess I can say, with which our agents act is noticeably different as well. Let me give you a glimpse of what title companies do. Title insurance, of course, is the standard document by which purchasers of real estate and lenders who make loans on real estate use to verify the identity of the owner and the existence of liens. So that in any sale of real estate and in any refinancing of real estate, title insurance will become required by purchasers and by lenders. To a lesser extent, attorneys who represent those who foreclose mortgages request title insurance before they initiate the action so that they can tell who the necessary parties defendant are. So the title company then searches the title in the courthouse. There are 72 counties in Wisconsin. We search the title in the courthouse where the land is located, not in Waukesha County, but here in Milwaukee County. and we list all the unsatisfied mortgages, all the judgments, the federal tax liens, the child support liens, the property taxes, pending divorce, receivership, et cetera, for the attorney to evaluate and determine who the necessary party is. There are some other oddball situations, such as quiet title actions, partition actions. Counsel for the plaintiff in those cases needs to know who the necessary party's defendant are. Unfortunately, in divorce, family law, and in estate planning, attorneys don't require any verification of the title. And so, in those cases, we see sometimes that the deed that transfers the title to the trust has a bad legal description and so forth. So, those are our customers. These are the events that trigger a transfer of ownership. A title company, what are they like? What's it like to work inside a title office? A title office in Iron County, population 5,000, may have one employee, whereas in Milwaukee County, you will have a title company with 100 employees. And inside that office here in this area, you will have two groups of people primarily. One is a group of people who are at the courthouse who are in our office examining documents but not speaking or communicating with anyone. They're very introspective people. They search title. We call them abstractors. The other group of people who talk to outside attorneys and customers are called examiners. They analyze the documents and then they decide who the owner is and decide whether or not a mortgage is still enforceable or it's void. And they have communication skills who you can actually call them and talk to them. And of course, in a bigger office, you'll have management, you'll have counsel. Our office has perhaps 70 employees. We have two counsels and a sales department. Title companies, relative to other enterprises, tend to be very objective, very conformist, and very cautious. There is no hip-hop version of title insurance, okay? There's no counterculture, and there's good reasons for it. We're very orthodox. The kind of title insurance commitment, that's the document you get before a closing. The policy is the document you get after. The commitment issued by Title Company A will look remarkably like the commitment that is issued by Title Company B. So there's an orthodoxy that prevails among all the title companies because nobody wants to be accused of insuring an unmarketable and unorthodox title. So that means that among all the title companies in Milwaukee, there's something like 60 different title agencies at the moment. Among all those different title agencies, no matter which one of them you communicate with, the way that they look at the world at large when they analyze the public land records in the Registry of Deeds office is they will put every conceivable kind of mortgage, lien, encumbrance into one of three different categories. The first category, we think that this mortgage is valid, and therefore we're going to show it to the prospective purchaser or lender in the title commitment. The second category is, we think this mortgage is void, so we will not show it in the commitment. What would that be? A mortgage that was recorded 31 years ago would not show up in a commitment. Why not? Because there is a 30-year statute of repose, section 893.33, paren 5, of the Wisconsin statute's time bars mortgages that were recorded more than 30 years ago. Okay. So we have category 1, yes liens, category 2, no liens, and category 3, maybe liens. In other words, most of the time that the title company examiners spend before they issue their document, their commitment, is looking at a group of mortgages that may be valid or may not be valid, and because there is enormous time pressure inside a title company office to expedite, because many title companies say, we can have your commitment issued within 48 hours of your calling us for the commitment. And of course, the realtor broker will not call the title company till the last minute, and the title company has to expedite issuing that commitment. So the third category of liens, defects, or encumbrances might have all kinds of random mortgages, liens, etc., and the title examiner doesn't have enough time to analyze whether or not that particular mortgage is in fact enforceable, so they will kick the ball down the road by showing that mortgage, that may be valid mortgage, in the commitment, and they will talk about it later. In our world, in residential transactions, 90% plus transactions, the buyer is not represented by counsel. And so we know that if we show something in the commitment and the buyer is not represented by counsel, the buyer is probably not going to say anything about it. They will just go ahead and close. In the other 10% of the cases, if we know that, I won't say the names of the firms, but one of your firms represents the buyer, we know that we have to be a little bit more circumspect about what we show on that commitment, and we may take more time to analyze the title rather than throwing, rather than issuing the commitment that has seven different possibly invalid judgments in it. We will look at it. A perfect example of the kind of equivocal possibly enforceable item that we will show in a commitment if we're in a hurry would be a construction lien claim. A construction lien claim is a claim that's one that can be filed if the lien claimant had done work on the property, whether it's plumbing or painting or electrical work or landscaping. Anyone who does work within the meaning of the statute in Chapter 779 has the right to file a lien. And so we can look at the four corners of a construction lien claim and we can tell that it's invalid because the notice wasn't given early enough. But do we show it? Yes, we do, because we're worried that the lien claimant might still try to enforce it anyway. That would be an example of a potential lien that we would likely show. The title document, as I said, is called a title insurance commitment, and it has the same component parts in every transaction. It says the name of the owner. It has the legal description, we call it. In other words, the description of the property. So if the property is in a subdivision, there will be a lot number and a subdivision name. If it's in a condominium on Prospect Avenue, it will have a unit number and a condominium name. If it's a certified survey map, that's another common land division mechanism that's used in Jefferson County, some of the outlying counties, it will have a lot number and a certified survey map number. Assessor's plats, timeshares, these are some of the fringe kinds of land division documents that one will see that will show up in the commitment. So we've got one, the owner, two, the property description, three, all the mortgages, judgments, state tax liens, federal tax liens, property taxes, and finally, third and last, on the third and last page of the commitment will be easements, restrictive covenants, mineral reservations, reverters, things that tend to transcend, that survive the closing, and, you know, some people don't even look on that page. The realtors don't look on that page. They just look on the second page where the mortgages are. So that's the commitment. And so when you receive a commitment, you have to look at it, of course, to make sure it has the real description of the property that your client intends to buy.
Twain, can I interrupt you there for a minute? A lot of my clients are doing loan modifications frequently with the attorneys in this room, and we're seeing some of these modified loans are actually a 40-year term, and you mentioned a 30-year mm-hmm. statute of repose on mortgages. My mm-hmm. clients have problems with 10 years left on these 40-year loans?
Yeah, it's a great question. Your clients do have problems because the state law hasn't caught up with federal finance.
As if they didn't have enough problems already.
I think that the only way that your client can be, you know, 30 years from now, I won't be here anymore, so this I only have so much interest in this question, but I think that the client, you know, from an institutional standpoint, the client should probably be advised that to mark their calendar in the year 2044 to record what Section 89333 says, a notice of renewal, so that their mortgage isn't time-barred. And I see that done by farm lenders in Wisconsin, like AgriBank and some of the other lenders, Badger and some of those. Yeah, that is a problem. Yeah. Any questions on anything I've said so far? I'm sort of giving you the boring background. One of the things that I want to say who our customers are, buyers, lenders. The name of the insured person on your homeowner's policy would be you, right? Well, the name of the insured on the title insurance policy would be the buyer or the lender, not the seller, not the realtor, not the attorney for the parties. Title insurance does not protect any of the other parties. It isn't uncommon for us after we insure a buyer and for whatever reason we fail to show a valid mortgage in the commitment, which we end up paying. We cut a check for $100,000. We then turn around and sue the seller based on a breach of warranty of title, of encumbrance, in the deed that they signed. So we don't protect sellers, even though the council think we should at the hearing. You know, they say, well, you gave clear title. You should protect the seller as well. No, we don't. We have a right of subrogation to bring suit for any payment we made on behalf of our insurer. At least that's our position. It's up to the judge, of course, but that's our position. And what is the policy amount? We have a number of very frugal, Wisconsin's a very frugal state, right? Milwaukee is notoriously frugal when it comes to apparel and other things like that. And they're also very frugal when they come to title insurance purchasing, because we have investors who want to buy a property worth $500,000, and when it comes time to paying me, they want to pay me the least amount possible, which would be $375 for a title premium. That's the lowest amount that my company, that any company in Wisconsin, can issue a title insurance policy for. And that gets to a policy amount of $15,000. Nothing makes my manager more angry than the fact that I would issue a commitment for $15,000 for a shopping mall or for a strip mall or something like that, which is worth $5 million. We try to avoid doing that. So the policy amount should reflect the actual consideration paid by the buyer to the seller. One last comment I would have, just by way of context, is, and this is the apologist for my product in me, says that anyone who buys real estate, whether it's from your sister-in-law or a good friend, should never pay money for that property without first making a search of the public land records to verify that who you're paying really is the owner. And the reason for that is because anything filed in the public land records in the courthouse imparts constructive notice on prospective purchasers or prospective lenders. In other words, even if, you know, it's sort of like if you go to Africa and you don't get malaria shots, no one will feel sorry for you if you come back and you're sick. And the same thing applies to prospective buyers. No one should feel sorry for you. The judge shouldn't feel sorry for you if you went ahead and paid for the title, only to find out that after closing there was a $300,000 unsatisfied mortgage, and now there's a mortgage foreclosure commenced against you. So, you know, the statute laws in every state impart constructive notice of anything in the records. So that's my defense of what I sell. And it isn't just about dishonest sellers. It's about people with issues going on in their lives, whether it's bankruptcy, divorce, foreclosure. A number of people who I encounter who are lay people don't know that the home equity line that they got in 2007 was secured by a mortgage. They didn't lie to me on the affidavit that I asked them to sign saying, do you have any mortgages? No. They just didn't know that. They didn't realize it's secured by a second mortgage. I think what I would like to do is just tell you, you know, in terms of, rather than searching the title yourself before you pay money to someone, you can get three different alternative kinds of documents. You can buy them in the marketplace, and they're attached to the material. The first, of course, the most common in 99% of all transactions is title insurance. The second is abstract of title on page 3. On page 1 of the material, an abstract of title is a running history of the title. So if you want to know who owned the property you were about to buy in 1860 when the Civil War was, you can actually find that out by getting an abstract of the title. And we have half the people in the Register of Deeds office are not professional searchers that work for my company, but rather genealogists who are just there, you know, because they're interested in finding history of property. So we're competing with these people for elbow space sometimes. But you can do that if you get an abstract. And third and last, the least expensive possible way of getting title information relative to the other two I just mentioned is a letter report. For $75 or $100 or $150, you can get a snapshot of the title that says what the name of the owner is and what mortgages have been recorded since the date that the last deed was recorded. So those are your three choices. The customers that I work with, 99% of them get title insurance because the standard offer to purchase that's used in the state of Wisconsin, all the offers now, I think, require that title insurance be provided by the seller to the buyer, not an abstract as it was in the 1980s, not a letter report. But lenders who, especially those who originate second mortgages, do get a lot of letter reports because, you know, they think that, they feel that it's worth the additional risk. They don't need to know whether there are easements or restrictions affecting the title. They don't care about that. They just want to know, are there any mortgages?
Let me ask Andy and Tim, do debtors' attorneys ever get letter reports? I mean, they don't care about an insurance component. They just want to know what's out there.
I have on occasion, but it depends more on the client than me. They have to shell out the money. You know, I mean, it doesn't sound like a lot, $100, $150, but to some of my clients, it is a lot.
Are they surprised with the results?
I haven't had anything shocking come up. I haven't. I mean, I'm sure that you could get something weird, but it usually gives a nice... Where it helps me is if I'm having trouble finding out who holds a second mortgage, which is mostly what I'm concerned about because we're in the context of lien stripping here. It'll at least give me the document that I'm looking for, the last recorded document and the assignments. So it'll tell me, and I can go get that document then.
So if you're going to start an adversary proceeding to strip off the second mortgage, that money you've spent on the letter report is going to point you in the right direction.
Yes. Yes.
As far as judgments, so if you've got a Chapter 7 and you want to find all the judgments so that you can go in and satisfy those, do you need a letter report or can you just use CCAP or something like that to find those judgments?
CCAP is generally...
You can. If you have a real common name, that can become problematic with CCAP. You can end up with, you know, 300 lawsuits on there, and you got to figure out who's yours and who's not.
But you should be doing one or the other.
Oh, right, yes.
In a 7.
Yes. You should be searching. We routinely search CCAP with the clients because hopefully they know
who they
that's
are.
Not them, you know.
Yeah, sometimes you go through the list.
They'll say sometimes they're not sure.
Yeah.
That might be me. I've heard that many a time.
Right. I might point you to page 7 of the material just to highlight something that you get when you pay for title insurance that you don't get when you pay for a letter report or you do your own search. And that is unique to Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and a couple of other states. In Wisconsin, if you go to the courthouse and submit to the Register of Deeds office a mortgage to record, and the mortgage is not indexed, how could that happen? Of course, if any of you use the public library, if you're looking for a book by Stephen King or anybody, you go to a card catalog under K for King. In other words, the same rule applies when anyone searches titles to real property. They look under K for King. If a mortgage that was granted by King is misindexed under J for Jones, and it doesn't show up in the index, it is as if the mortgage was never recorded at all. The mortgage is void. And that's bad. And how often does that happen? I would say twice a year. I get claims like this where the lender initiates a foreclosure action against my insured. And, of course, we get a tender of defense, and we defend, and we get the case dismissed. Mortgage did not impart constructive notice. Same thing with judgments. If you use CCAP, I've had a number of cases where in one county, the clerk of court's office in Ashland County for a year, they had a new employee. They indexed the judgments under the creditor's name rather than the debtor's name. And we pointed that out to them. They say, well, oh, okay, thank you for telling us. People, title companies who have staff on the ground see these things that happen, and you know, this is one of the things you get. You get coverage for the cost of defense, and you get an insurance company to pay you when this happens. But when we record mortgages, we go back the next week and make sure not only do it's like at the drop-off window, you drop the mortgage off and goodbye. You come back later and make sure that the Register of Deeds employee made an entry in the proper column of the alphabetical index we call the grantor-grantee index, and in the proper lot number for the tract index, which is an index by parcel number, to make sure that there really was an entry made so anyone searching the title in the future understands that Bank of America really does have a mortgage against this property. Our customer is Bank of America. Now, you know, one of the odd things is in Wisconsin we have mortgages. In the state where I'm with the law school, we had deeds of trust. Once in a while, I see a deed of trust recorded. And where does the employee of the Register of Deeds index a deed of trust? They index it in the index for deeds. So that means it's never going to show up as a mortgage. That is not good. And we tell, when we get the document, in the greater scheme of things, 90% of all the documents that are recorded in Wisconsin are sent right to me, my office, and we look at them before we record them, and we tell the sender of the document, Bank of America, there's something wrong with your document. And they say, thank you so much. Would you please fix it for us? We will. But the other 10% gets sent right to the Register's office, and if a deed of trust goes there, it's like, you know, it's, why did you even bother? You know, so there are some things to be very careful of. It would be always a good idea, if you're recording a document, to send the document to the title company, unless you have a lot of experience in troubleshooting with documents. Any questions or comments so far? I think now we're going to talk about really the topic that is of interest particularly, and that is lien stripping. On page 7, you know, mortgages, of course, are the most common kind of encumbrance against real estate that one will find in the greater scheme of things. And when a mortgage is satisfied, the mortgage is as if it never existed at all. The satisfaction takes care of that. I might point out something that happened in December. There was a new law enacted effective December 12th of 2014 that provides the closing agent that dispersed payment of a loan the power to satisfy a mortgage if the lender, after a notice of 30 days by the closing agent to satisfy it, does not satisfy it themselves. So that helps in sale transactions and refinances. It helps the title companies clear up without any permission from the lender to satisfy the mortgage, as if the lender itself executed and recorded the satisfaction. It's cited on page 9 of the material, section 70815. We think that this statute is going to clear up a lot of stale mortgages in the public land records.
I think it's also going to help debtors and debtors' attorneys. These lien stripping adversary proceedings, we see most of the lenders are just consenting to these. There's just no value in the properties. They're not going to hold on to a second mortgage that's worthless. So we'll enter into these stipulations. And there, when we were here last October, I provided a couple samples that my office uses. There's one sort of rough spot in the process, though, and it's at the end of the bankruptcy case where the debtor gets a discharge. How do they actually translate that into releasing the mortgage on their property? The mechanism we have in the stipulation is basically, let me know when the discharge is entered. I'll let my client know, and they'll release the mortgage. In theory, that's how it should work, but as we all know, that things don't always work so smoothly. So this might be something the debtor's attorneys could use if they're not getting the response from the lender, if they can put in the affidavit that you know, this lien is going to be released pursuant to an adversary proceeding, that I've got a discharge now.
The lender's gone under themselves.
Yeah,
they don't exist anymore. That's a problem.
Is that going to take these mortgages off the title from your perspective, do you think?
To comply with the new statute, section 70815, it's called an affidavit of satisfaction. It's not called a satisfaction. It's called an affidavit of satisfaction. It can only be signed by someone authorized by a title insurer. And, you know, the Wisconsin Land Title Association, which is the trade association for the title agents and the title insurance companies they represent, really was responsible for this three-page statute to be enacted in December. And that doesn't mean the statute can't be amended again, but it just means that the payment has to have been by a title, by a closing agent, and the title insurance company has the sole authority to appoint someone to execute the affidavit of satisfaction. So I think it works in voluntary transactions. I don't think it's going to work, though, in that kind of setting. I'd have to go back and read the statute, but I don't think it was designed for that.
So the title company's designee wouldn't delve into the details of the bankruptcy? And
I don't think so. We could look at that. I hadn't thought about that before now. Be happy to look at that. Well, The question of bankruptcy court orders having the effect of eradicating, eliminating mortgages is an intriguing one for us. I must say that before today, I had no sense of how many orders that stripped down liens there might have been entered by the courts. And I'm puzzled because I don't see very many such orders in what we do, which is researching the title in connection with a sale. I've seen maybe 6 or 8 of them. And when I've seen them, I think we've gotten comfortable with all of them that it was safe for us to issue a title policy ensuring a purchaser of the property from the debtor that had filed Chapter 13, and there was an order stripping down the mortgage. We deleted the mortgage. We verified, of course, that there was a discharge, because we're not in the circuit that we're in a circuit where a discharge is required, I think. But we're very cautious. What does the title insurance company look for before it will remove from the title insurance commitment and policy an unsatisfied mortgage that was the subject of a stripping lien order by the bankruptcy court or a plan in which the second mortgage was stripped down? We would look for an order, of course, that referred to the specific mortgage. And you don't just do that by saying the mortgage affecting Cherry Street. You say, the mortgage recorded as document number blank, and insert the document number that appeared on the face of the mortgage that was stamped by the Registered Deeds Office. It should have a property description or legal description inserted on the order so that when the order is submitted for recording to the Registered Deeds Office, the mortgage ends up being put in the place where everyone searching the title will find it, the tract index and its parallel index, the alphabetical grantor-grantee index. Otherwise, as a practical matter, any title insurance company is going to show the mortgage as if it was never the subject of such an order. Of Wisconsin's 72 counties, there are only 3 counties in which any bankruptcy proceeding imparts constructive notice to prospective purchasers: Dane, Eau Claire, and Milwaukee. In those counties, all the title companies search the bankruptcy proceedings that are filed. But if you go across the county line into Brookfield or Bayside, the part of Bayside on the other side, or Caledonia, you just cross that invisible line. And now in those counties, the only way you can make sure that anything that occurred in the bankruptcy court proceeding is constructive notice is by recording a certified copy. Even in Milwaukee County, I cannot imagine a title company. Let's just put it this way. Keep it easy. I think it's a terribly good idea to record a certified copy of the court order in the Registered Deeds Office in all 3 counties, Dane, Eau Claire, and Milwaukee, even if the title companies do search those court case files on PACER before they issue the title insurance commitment and policy. I can't imagine why one wouldn't want to record a certified copy in all counties, all 72 counties. What else should the order contain? There shouldn't be any equivocal language about whether or not the mortgage is no longer enforceable. I'm working with a firm that represents a debtor in a different case, not a Chapter 13 right now, in which there was a very complex order entered by the district court in the Eastern District that talks about enforceability of the mortgage. And I'm just on the fence about whether or not the language of the court is sufficiently clear on whether or not the mortgage is null and void. It talks about not being enforceable. Well, did you ever hear about something called reformation? That could have the retroactive effect once a mortgage is reformed to add the correct legal description that was messed up in the first place, corrected by reformation action in circuit court, then you can go ahead and foreclose. I don't know if that order leaves the door open to that kind of what amounts to a collateral attack on the result. So I'm not quite comfortable yet, and we're looking for another court order by the Eastern District to make sure that the mortgage has been satisfied. So any unequivocal statement, any unequivocal language that to the effect that the mortgage is determined to be null and void would be a plus. That's pretty much all I have.
My experience, frankly, I see a lot of these adversary proceedings aimed at stripping junior liens, and I don't think I've seen one yet that refers to the senior mortgage by, you know, document number, recording information, or the junior mortgage as well. It just says there's a first mortgage on property A, the debtor's property, and there's a second mortgage, and the second should be stripped. We know what they're talking about, but it doesn't have the precision that perhaps title companies prefer. But then what does?
Well, we are seeing the legal description in the order.
Right.
So now you're saying add the recording information of the original mortgage?
I usually put document numbers in the
order. Right, so that's not so hard.
But remember, the order now from the adversary is simply declaring that it's an unsecured debt and subject to modification by the plan. I think where you, if you're looking for an order to strip the lien, I think it has to be in the confirmation order combined with the discharge order. Between the two of those, you're stripping the lien. So I think the plan has to state that you're stripping this lien, this mortgage, document number, blah, 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 by whoever, with this and this legal description. I think that has to be in the confirmation order. The plan is what's stripping the mortgage now.
So you can record the confirmation order and the discharge order?
I would think that right now, I mean, I don't know what the new rules are going to do.
In the court's order.
But I think right now I would record the adversary order stating that this is an unsecured claim.
Right.
I would record the confirmation order stating that you know, corresponding mortgage is null and void, and the discharge order.
Well, the confirmation order wouldn't necessarily say that unless the plan is attached, and the plan says that.
Or well, separately provides in the confirmation order.
Yeah, or you'd have to attach the plan and the confirmation order confirming that plan, and the plan has the language in there. But, because I think that's the operative order now. I mean, I know we do adversaries, but I think the adversaries now, and I don't remember the Seventh Circuit case name, maybe one of you does, I think the plan strips the mortgage now. I think the adversary says this is an unsecured debt. That's what the orders say now. This is an unsecured debt and therefore subject to modification under 1322B4.
Right.
So I think the operative order is going to be the combination. I mean, you can have the adversary order, the judgment order, the confirmation order with the plan, and the discharge order. I think you almost need all three. I don't know that we're going to need adversaries after the new rules go through. I don't know what they're going to do with that. Obviously, I'm not on any special committee. But I think you need a combination of all three. I think you need the confirmation order, and the plan has to state you're stripping the mortgage. I think you need the discharge order, and I like having the adversary judgment. I like having the declaratory judgment stating that this is I do like that. Whether that goes away with the new national model plan or whatever they have going on, I don't know. But I like having that order saying this is an unsecured claim. That way, it's clear that the plan can modify it. But I think you need to record all three. Before that Seventh Circuit decision, just the adversary order said right in it that this mortgage is null and void. I think for those cases, you just need that order. And in fact, I know my orders routinely said that if the mortgage company doesn't release the lien, that you can use this order and the order of discharge to do so.
And if the debtor isn't eligible for a discharge, I think that was Judge Pepper's fair decision.
Yeah, that's up in the air in this district,
whether
you
need a discharge or not.
Is that in the Seventh Circuit, is it? Is it in the Seventh Circuit?
Not that I know of.
Not yet, but we've got conflicting district court decisions on whether you need a discharge or not.
Although the only circuit level authority says that you don't need a discharge.
In a different
circuit? Just not in the circuit. Yeah, but it is the only law.
Right.
That's the one thing.
Can
I just turn back to the language in the judgment order? You indicated that the words null and void are kind of what you're looking for if you're the title company. And we toss around release the lien, satisfy the mortgage,
strip
unenforceable
the lien. mortgage like you, which obviously you're not comfortable with. So I think what a lot of us are wondering is, you know, what are the magic words that a title company will look at and go, ah, got it. Are they null and void? What's the magic language?
The magic language is whatever it takes of the 500 people who are gainfully employed in the title business across this state would most readily jump at and say, we understand that, because the last thing you want is to wait for a closing to occur, because this question has to wind its way to one of the counsel in the title company organization. It's much better to have the entry-level person look at it and say, oh, I understand, it's void. It'll get to one of the council. It'll get to me, and if it says strip down, I get that, and it's fine. But it would be better to entitle the name. It would be better to put a little ornamentation on this court order, so that anyone who looks at it, who works for a title company, would see, oh, it's no good anymore. It's in their colloquial way, it's void. And that way, I think, if the closing is at 10:30 in the morning, you know, it's not going to hold the thing back. Otherwise, if I'm in a meeting like I am now, then they're gonna be six of these waiting for me when I get back, and I can only process this stuff that quickly. So the more unequivocal that the order looks like to someone, the better. Null and void, satisfied, all that is good. Yeah.
Tim, what do you think about the... What are you going to record to give your clients the most comfort? Are you going to go with
the we've changed our policy as well, that we're making the plan fit more on what we had in the adversary order before. So we now have the adversary, which is essentially unsecuring the mortgage, and now the plan is stating what exactly we're doing with that mortgage. Putting in the recording number, we can do that, but that's also attached to as an exhibit in the adversary. So I think before we were covered by that being one of the exhibits that you can refer to. I mean, it makes you jump a little bit farther, but that's easy to put in
right.
The...
It seems to me it's easy enough to add.
Right, that you would just say...
the legal description,
right.
You just add the recording.
Bank of America's mortgage recorded
right,
as...
Right, recorded blah, 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 enough
right.
of that, yeah.
And
right.
Make sure you get the numbers right.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Because we always look at the numbers anyway for the
order
of junior and senior lien.
Ideally, I would just love to be able to see just one order being able to be recorded, satisfy, you know, the title company. I mean,
the only problem I see is if these adversaries stretch out and some
well, the
courts
only order
are,
can
some
do
courts
that
are
is the order at the you know at the end of the day after either
right.
the plan is complete or discharge enters, depending on which camp you're in.
Right.
So you'd have to come back and you'd have to get an order that says, yeah, either discharge has occurred or the plan has been completed, and the plan provides for the termination of this mortgage. And at that point, you could have an order that brings it all to rest. But before then, so if you file any of this stuff, the confirmation order, the plan, the adversary judgment, but the plan is ongoing, from the title insurer's perspective, what do you have?
Well, maybe I'd understand the complexity of the proceeding, but...
If you assume, Dwayne, in year one, the debtor files a plan, gets it confirmed, and it says, I'm stripping
yes.
Jay's client's
yes.
mortgage.
Yes.
In our district, we also require an adversary proceeding. This may change in 2 years, but for now, we require an adversary proceeding, basically doing the same thing. And they file this adversary proceeding... Jay doesn't answer or stipulates, and they get an order. And this order will say something like, pursuant to the adversary, they didn't answer, the lien, there's no equity for this lien to attach to. It's therefore effective on completion of the plan and the granting of a discharge, the lien is null and void or the lien is satisfied. We would like to record that, the debtor's attorney would like to record that now in year one.
Yes.
And then in 5 years, after the discharge is granted, the case is closed, have that be effective so that when the debtor goes to sell or refi
yes.
in year seven, not have any problems
yes.
and not come back to the lawyer who's closed his file or retired
yes.
to Florida or whatever. So that's our challenge, is getting an order that's kind of contingent on a future event that could be
yes.
5 years down the road. But that's the nature of it. They're not waiting till the fifth year to try to strip this. They can't, because they want the claim of this mortgage treated unsecured for the whole 5 years.
Right.
So we're trying to craft language and not so many pages and contingencies. And
well, you have the contingency. The debtor's got to either complete the plan or get a discharge.
Right.
And then record that.
As a follow-up, in other words, at the conclusion, at the completion of the plan, record yet another order.
Well, you record the discharge. But, I would prefer there not be another order. I mean, if you use the same order from 3 years ago that said, upon granting of the discharge, you get the lien satisfied, and then once you got the discharge...
Yes.
Record it again if you want to, because that's got all the information, like the legal description and the document numbers. Attach that discharge, and you have satisfied the contingency.
I agree. It might be helpful at that point for counsel for the debtor to record by covering that order an affidavit to the effect that the plan has been completed. This would be an affidavit that would be simple, common sense language to someone in a great hurry looking at the chain of title. This affidavit is given for the purpose of attaching confirmation of plan or noticing anyone searching the title that the plan has been confirmed completed, and that therefore the order dated 2007 stripping down the mortgage to XYZ Mortgage Company is of no further force or effect, or something like that.
Yeah.
Two sentences. The recording fees, of course, are $30. Not a great expense. So that might be the streetwise simplest way of making the title as clear as humanly possible, so that then the property can be immediately sold.
The risk would be is suppose you get that adversary order that says upon completion of the plan, 3 years from now, you get the lien avoided. You wouldn't necessarily have to record that at the time you get the order.
No.
It would not have to be recorded until you've met all the contingencies.
Right.
The danger would be is if the attorney puts that in a file to do it 3 years from now and then forgets, or everybody forgets.
Then you hope you're in Dane, Milwaukee, or Clare County.
Yeah. And then if you're in a county where the title company will actually go back and check for the discharge, then you're okay. But if you're in any other county, you've got to record again after the discharge.
That's right. I like the idea of recording that contemporaneous with the entry of the order itself. I've had so many cases in 363 orders where the property was sold 4 years ago, there was an order. Our title agent up north says, "Well, I can't understand. There's a break in the chain of title. How did the title get from A to, from that company to that company? I don't understand that. If they recorded the order then, so now the title agent in Lincoln County, where there's no bankruptcy court, has to call somebody in one of the other counties and find out, well, where was the bankruptcy? Look at the court case file. 5 hours later, people are waiting at the closing. What's going on? This is not good for the debtor." Recording, it seems to me that recording is not a waste of money. Yes?
All right, great. We're out of time, unfortunately. It was a great presentation.
You sort of did this on the fly.
Came in late. There was a review of the metal count in the law enforcement. The judges are on top. Next month, March 11th, we've got unusual or difficult assets to value in bankruptcy. I think I saw Len Leverson. I'm sure he'll be here for that. There he is. But Greg Holdis and Steve McDonald are going to present. So please come back on March 11th. Thank you very much. Make sure to sign in for your CLE. Wayne's outline is now on, but we put the old outline on the lien stripping, so you can find the materials online. And those in the remote locations, let Paula know so your name gets reported to the CLE. Well, thanks again. See you next month.
I like that joke. I like that joke. That was